This week's sermon is from the series Trusting God in Life's Muck, a sermon series on the life of Joseph.
I don't know if you have paid attention or not, but or if you're an Animal Channel person. I used to love animal shows when I was a kid. And you may not know it, but the birth of a baby giraffe is kind of an interesting event. One, they don't really lay on the ground like you would normally think with being as tall as they would. The babies literally have to drop to the ground. And the moms spend their time doing what moms do. They lick all the fluids off to make sure they're breathing. But once they get up on their feet, they do something that actually might seem kind of mean. And that is, they literally kick the baby and force them to go on the ground. Now, the baby struggles to get up and they start getting on their feet again. And wouldn't you know it, the mom usually kicks them again and knocks them down. Now, to us, we look at that and think, what kind of a mom is that? What kind of a parent would do that kind of a thing to their newborn baby? Don't they know that they are just struggling to get alive? But they know, the mom instinctively knows, that that baby needs to be able to get up quickly and run. And so from the very beginning, they make them go through this kind of adversity. They do something that may seem kind of difficult and mean at first, but they actually have it in a very loving kind of a way. There's a reason why they do that. Well, I don't know about you, but life can kind of lay us on the ground. There's all kinds of different things that we can knock us off our feet. We can go through health issues. We can go through relational issues. We can go through job issues. We can have people that we thought shouldn't treat us a certain way, and they treat us difficult in a terrible kind of a way, and that can really hurt us. But how we respond to those moments really matters, and how we view them and what we believe about them has a huge impact on the way that we live our lives. And so today, we are continuing our sermon series on Joseph. We here at Crossway like to just preach through a book, and so we picked up Genesis halfway through, and we're going to be studying the life of Joseph. Last week, we looked at his dreams and his coat, and today we're going to see that he is sold by his brothers. And we're going to see how God can use even difficult things ultimately for our good, which is a good reminder for us in the midst of everything that we have going on. If there's kind of a point that I want you to kind of walk away from, it's this, that God can use everything, including evil deeds of Joseph's brothers, to begin fulfilling his plan, and this is really fulfilling Joseph's dream and ultimately going to make Joseph a ruler, as we know, those of us who know the story. But think about that. God doesn't necessarily, is not the instigator of the evil. He allows it to happen, but he can use evil deeds to bring about his plan. Nothing can stop that plan from happening. And in the midst of all the chaos that we have, elections, COVID, difficult life's just difficulties in general, I think that's a good reminder for us to remember, and I think it will be a timely passage for us. So Genesis 37, 12 through 36, we read the NIV here. We don't have pew Bibles because of COVID, but you can grab your own Bible or you can follow along as I read. If you do want to pull up the app, I think that's the right code there that you can get to the events, or just pull up the YouVersion and it will tell you that we have it, the notes right here, right now. This is the word of the Lord. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send them to you." "Very well," he replied. So he said to them, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He replied, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they're grazing their flocks?" "They have moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes the dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of those cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what becomes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into a cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty, and there was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brothers and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." And his brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it and see whether it is your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph surely has been torn into pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on a sackcloth, and mourned for his son for many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Well, really, as we look at this story, we're going to view that there's different acts in this. I mean, often when we come to Scripture, we forget that there is a narrative. There is kind of the author who writes this has kind of scenes that he's created for us. And in this passage, we have a number of different scenes. The first scene is the scene that where Joseph is sent to check on his brothers. Now, last week, we talked about this robe that he was given. Now, traditionally, most of us, if you grew up in Sunday school like us, it's referred to as a cloak of many colors. And that is because the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, uses words to describe that. That's the imagery that they use. Well, the Hebrew word for it is actually this kind of long, flowing cloak. And it's definitely not one that you would use if you did manual labor. Now, it's very possible it could be multicolored because it would have shown kind of the richness and the bigness of all of this. But this is really the heart of it. And last week I said that this long and ornate robe would have probably hinted that not only was Jacob showing favoritism to his son Joseph because the other boys didn't get it, but he was naming him in kind of a managerial or a leadership role with going against the dreams that Joseph communicated that all of his brothers and even his dad and his mothers would bow down to him, definitely fed into this animosity that we had. And you'll see here in the beginning of 12 that we see that came to fruition. Joseph is at home while his brothers tend the flock, which was not the case in the beginning of chapter 37 where he was tending with them. And so we see that this family divide, this dysfunction that we saw, this kind of Joseph versus brothers is at play right here. Now, the brothers had to move on to Shechem, which was a 50-mile drive. And so Jacob said he's worried about them, and he sends Joseph to check on them. If you're curious what it is, here's a picture of the map. It literally is 50 miles from Hebron all the way up to Shechem. It's very likely that they needed to have some new grass at the areas that they were tending or something like that. Weren't having enough substance for their sheep, and so they had to go in that direction to take care of them. But Jacob had reason to be concerned, because if you look at your Bibles, in Genesis 35, Shechem is the city that Simeon and Levi plundered. You can read it right there, and actually 34 is what I should have said. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking them as plunder in their house. And we see that they avenged the rape of their sister by literally destroying the entire city. And so the fact that they are up in that area and that all the people who know that they did this are around, you can see why Jacob would be nervous and worried about his sons and whether or not they were at okay, or it literally says whether they were at peace. You can see where this would weigh on him. And so he does that. He sends his son from Hebron up to Shechem and to go and check on them. Now, when Joseph arrives, he can't find the brothers. And I don't know if you've ever had it, but I was watching a show with my daughters a couple of days ago. They were watching some of the TV shows that they have that reenact the old Babysitter Club books. But in this particular episode, a girl was babysitting and noticed all of a sudden, as soon as the mom left, that the oldest boy that she was supposed to watch was missing, and chaos and fear and everything happened. She called her mom. She called her friends. She called all the boys' friends trying to find them and even ended up calling the police. There's a frantic moment in all of that. Turns out that this kid was just with his dad. The mom hadn't bothered to tell her that. And so it was all for nothing. And the same was case here in Joseph. But I want you to think about making this 50-mile trek as a 17-year-old boy and to get there knowing that your brothers may not be okay and not being able to find them, how hard it would be and how devastating it would be. Well, a stranger sees Joseph's franticness. It must be, because he comes up to him and asks him whether or not he's okay. What are you looking for? And Joseph replies that he's looking for his brother. And the stranger tells him that they moved over to Dothan, and which is another trek. And so the scene moves now there. Now in Dothan, the brothers are sitting there tending their flocks. And the Bible tells us that in that moment, they see Joseph coming from afar, far away. Now in this kind of act, we see that Joseph is attacked and sold. The brothers see him coming. And the Bible tells us that right away, the hatred and the jealousy that we've been seeing building in the first part of the passage is coming to a head. It doesn't even seem like they see him, and instantaneously they see the opportunity that they have to get rid of this dreamer and the negative impact they have on their family, and they're going to take advantage of it. And so they plot an attack to try and kill him and play it off as that an animal took his life to his father. And so we see that in this moment, right there, Joseph's life is at risk, and we wonder, will all these dreams that we had learned about in the first half of the being come to play? The brothers don't want it to happen. That's actually the reason why they say they should kill him, is because they want to see, make sure that these dreams, that them bowing down to the younger brother will never happen. They're so angry and so jealous that they will not bow down to him like their dreams say, that they will do everything in their path not to make it happen. But a voice of reason appears in the group. It's the oldest brother, Reuben, and he hatches a plan to save Joseph. Let's just not kill him. Let's not beat him. But rather, let's just put him in a cistern, one in a wilderness where no one will ever hear him, and let's let nature take its course, is what he says. That way the blood isn't really on our hands. We didn't kill him. Nature did, is kind of the argument that he makes. But really what Reuben's going to do is he's going to sneak in afterwards and save his brother. Now, we don't know why Reuben had that compassion. People kind of disagree. Some think it's that maybe he really did realize the depths of what they were doing and didn't want that to happen. He didn't want that on his hands. Others think that maybe because he's the oldest, it's a way for him to get into the good graces of his father. He had, after all, in this dysfunctional family, slept with the maidservant of his brother and lost probably his inheritance there. And so this could have easily been a way for him to try and get back into his father's good graces. We don't know. The commentator doesn't tell us, or Moses doesn't tell us that, the author of this. All we know is that he makes an attempt to try and save Joseph. Well, the brothers buy it. And they strip Joseph rather than killing him, and they throw him into a cistern. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with that word, cistern, or not. I grew up in Iowa, and we had a bunch of them. I still remember to this day, my grandparents had one right outside of their house, and it had a little hand pump. You know what I'm talking about? Those old ones that you pump, and you kind of bring it to life. And I remember how fun it was as a kid just to sit there and go up and down. I think sometimes my grandma probably did it because she wanted us to get our energy out, you know? But we would pump that water, and we would use it to water the animals or do those things. Well, in Israel, they have a wet season and a dry season. And so they would create these cisterns, these very deep, and sometimes you can even see elaborate ones under the city of Jerusalem that are dug out of limestone to catch the water and to store it in the rainy season so that they would have water for their animals and even themselves in the dry season. And what we're told is that the brothers stripped him of his clothes and they threw him into the cistern. Now, there's certain cues the Bible gives us that Joseph will not survive this because, one, if you look at where the cistern is located, it's not located in a populated area. It's located in the wilderness. You see that? It says that they threw him in a cistern in the wilderness. That was in this passage. Second, they tell us that it is there and it was empty, which means there is no water in it. Also, he doesn't have any clothes. And so in the cold night temperature in the ground, he is naked and vulnerable, and there is not even water for him to drink. And even though he could cry out for help, the fact that it's so away from everyone else makes it very, very unlikely that he will have any kind of a chance to live. Imagine what Joseph is feeling, the emotions that he's gone from being fearful that his brothers have died when he shows up at Shechem, to being so overjoyed when he finds them, and then to have his brothers turn on him and throw him into the cistern. Now, it doesn't say anything about him crying out for help, although it does say that they acknowledge that later in when they go to Egypt, that he did cry out for help. But imagine what this young man at 17 is going through, how fast his world got turned upside down. It broke him. He felt the effects of sin, of his brother's sin in his life. It would have been a very scary, dark moment in the bottom of that cistern, crying out for help. And the people who should care about him the most are the ones that put him down there. This is where Joseph is, overwhelmed by the darkness, overwhelmed by pain. What's striking to me, especially if we take this at their words back in Genesis 42, where they say that he cried out for help, is how callous the brothers are to their sin. It says that they threw him down there, they stripped him, they did all this, and then the next statement right out of their mouth is, out of Moses' mouth when he writes this, is that they sat down to eat their meal. I would hope that if I ever did anything this terrible, that my conscience would sear me, and the last thing I would want to do is to be able to eat. But the brothers are so callous to their own sin that they do this terrible thing, and they start eating their meal right away. And I think this is important for us to think about in our own lives. We saw it grow in the very beginning of this chapter. The words is they hated their brother. They hated him more. They hated him and were jealous of him. And we see the effects of sin's snowball in how it gets bigger and bigger and bigger in our lives. And we've said this before. We said this when we looked at the book of Judges, especially at the end, that we need to be careful because it can make our hearts hard and callous. And we see an example of this, that the brothers aren't even really totally aware. Now, Reuben did the right thing. I mean, he tried to save his brother, but they still eat in the midst of all of this. Now, we don't know where Reuben goes. We're just told that he disappears. And as they're eating, all of a sudden they see not this caravan of Ishmaelites or Midianites coming. And Judah says to himself, I see some potential here. Why let this life go to waste? Why not make some profit from us? This guy's brought us pain. He's brought us suffering. He's hurt us. Why just let him spoil away in a cistern? Let's sell him and get something out of it. And so he hatches this plan to his brothers. Let's not waste this. Let's sell him and let's take care of it. And that is exactly what they do. Now, some commentators in this kind of get hung up on the fact that they talk about the Ishmaelites and the Midianites, and it goes back and forth. You don't need to worry about this. Both of those people are from the same general area. It's not two stories, or it's not differences there. When Steph and I went up to Seattle, and when we run into people and they ask us where they're from, we usually say Portland. Well, we're not really from Portland, but if we say Vancouver, sometimes they forget that there's a Vancouver, Washington, and they right away assume Vancouver, BC. So we say we're from Portland when we're actually from Battleground. And as the conversation flows, we usually talk about that. Well, we actually live in Battleground and we live out in the country. We don't live in the city, blah, blah, blah. That's really kind of the language here. From a distance, they can tell that they, from their dress and their garb, that they were from this area, the Ishmaelites. But probably what happens as they get closer, either from their dialect or from the different customs or even from their conversation, they realize that they're dealing with actual Midianites. And that is who they sell them to. And so we see that this is what's happening. The brothers take advantage of the situation, and instead of killing Joseph, they sell him to these slaves or these slave traders and this caravan. Joseph's life is spared, but again, I want you to think about what that moment would have been like for him. He's crying out for help in the cistern, and finally something comes, but again, it's not the help, but rather he's bound up, and he is going to be completely ripped away from his home. The narrative is so easy for us just to gloss over that we forget the emotions of what these people are feeling, but it does tell us that when Reuben returned and when he went down to look at the cistern, he was distraught when he sees that Joseph isn't there. He rips his clothes and asks, "Where can I go now?" Because he knows that Joseph's, whatever happened to him, his death, or in this case his selling, is on really all of their shoulders, but his in particular. His conscience is at work. Well, the brothers in the very beginning had hatched a plan. What we're going to do is we're going to get rid of his coat and we're going to rip it up and we'll put blood on it and we'll bring it to dad to make him think that an animal killed it. And they do exactly those steps and they bring it, they cover up their sin. And they bring this bloody garment ripped to shreds to their brother. Think about the joy that they had. This garment that was a symbol of their father's favoritism. This garment that made their brother feel important and showed that maybe he may one someday rule, they got to rip into pieces and they covered it with blood. Hopefully there's also a searing of their conscience, but it doesn't really talk about that. Rather, they bring it there. They bring it to their father and they're tricky. They don't actually tell the lie. They just say, "We found this. You examine it. And you see if there is brothers, this is their your brother's joke, jacket or his robe." And what we see again is this snowball effect of sin. Their hatred snowballed and their lies snowball. One over the other over the other. Jacob takes the bait. He looks at the jacket. He sees the blood and he comes to the conclusion that everybody would. His son has been killed by an animal. He assumes the worst, as he should. And the end of the story is really all about a father who cannot be consoled. The language here is that he rips his clothes off, he puts on sackcloth, which is very normal. That's very normal. But see the language that it uses, that he mourned for days, and he refused to be comforted. And even though the brothers and Jacob's daughter came to try and comfort him, he refused. And the language is very much, I just want to die myself. And I want to join him there. That's how much of the pain and suffering he'd gone through. Now, unfortunately, here at Crossway, we don't need to talk about the depths of this pain, because we have people in our midst, even recently, who have lost sons. It is a difficult thing, and so you can imagine the pain and the suffering Jacob felt. He had lost Joseph's mother, Rachel, as a result of the childbirth, and now this son, his favorite son, the one whom he loved, that he put his hope in, that maybe would one day take over for him and get the blessing, is the language that we see kind of with the giving of the robe and all of this, is gone. And it devastates him. If that was the end of the story, it would be pretty depressing. And basically all we would say is, you know what? Here's an example of the depravity of the world, how messed up it is, and our hearts would be broken, and our hearts should be broken. It should be broken by what we see going on in the story, but that's not the end of the story. See, Moses masterfully weaves in one last verse. It's a verse that gives us hope that God is at work. There's something we need to see about this, and I hope you see in this passage. There's a truth here. Look, God's name is not necessarily written in here. If you see in all of Genesis 37, it does not really refer to God, the God of Yahweh, the God of the covenant, any name for God in here much. He doesn't even acknowledge that he's the one who gave the dreams, although we see in Genesis later that Joseph saw it that way, that God gave these dreams to him. But his name isn't written there, but the series of timely encounters are his handiwork. And what I want us to see is that that's often the way God works in our own life. There's two of them that I want to highlight in this passage where even though God may not have been given the credit, even though we may just say it's by chance, none of this is by chance. That God was at work using even the simple things as a person seeing Joseph distraught trying to find his brothers who happened to overhear that they were going to Dothan. And so he pushes them there. And even as the brothers are eating and callous, and they could have been totally consumed by their own anger and their rage and just left it at that, that Joseph could have been stuck in the cistern and died, as I said, stripped, naked, died of thirst and cold and hypothermia. But no, it just so happens, the author of Genesis tells us, Moses, that as they're eating a meal, out on the horizon comes this group. Dothan would have been on a trade route. And so we can see how God moves the story from Shechem to Dothan to the caravan. And that Joseph is brought into there. And so how this works in our own lives is in those moments when we wonder, where is God at work? What is God doing? I don't see it. I don't feel it. I don't know. It feels overwhelming. And Joseph would have felt that time and time and time again in this passage. It would have been emotional whiplash that he would have gone through. But yet, Moses wants to see that nothing happened by chance. God, even though he wasn't the instigator of the evil, allowed evil to happen, and he used it ultimately for his good. And we need to be reminded of that same truth in our own lives, that nothing in our lives happens by chance. Proverbs 16, verse 9 says, "In their hearts humans plan their courses, but the Lord establishes their steps." And there's this dance that we have about us being responsible. We need to make those choices, but yet knowing that God is at work in ways that are beyond our comprehension. And this gives us hope. There's a document called the Heidelberg Catechism, which is just basically a simple thing of faith. And it communicates this idea that I want us to get across here today. In question and answer 27, it says, "What do you understand by the providence of God?" And it says this, that the almighty and ever-present power of God, by which God upholds, as with his hand, heaven and earth and all creatures, and so rules them that a leaf and a blade, a rain and a drought, fruitful and lean years, food and drink, health and sickness, prosperity and poverty, all things in fact, come to us not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. And what that reminds us is that truth, that all things, even sometimes difficult things, even though he is not the instigator, he allows things to happen. And when we do not understand it, we can trust that those things will not necessarily break us and that God can use them ultimately for our good. And the story of Joseph reminds us of that, that the evil deeds of his brothers, terrible things, murder, wanting to commit murder, selling him into slavery, things that we should cry out against if we see it in our society around us because they are evil. But even those difficult things, those evil, evil, despicable things, did not stop God's plan for Joseph. That's why Moses ends with that passage like he does. "Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard." And if this was a movie, The cinematographer would have zoomed into the scene and probably put it there of Potiphar and maybe shown something with the pyramids behind or something like that for us to see that this boy who had these dreams that someday he would become the ruler is now in the place of Egypt and in close proximity to Pharaoh. And there would be this wonder, what's God up to? For those of us who know the end of the story, we know that God used these evil events and even more evil events. We're going to be camping on them for weeks to ultimately bring about Joseph's becoming the second in command in Egypt and saving not only the people of Egypt, but saving his own family. And these brothers who did despicable things will bow down to him as his dreams communicated last week. But Moses wants to end with hope because he wants us to realize that even evil deeds cannot stop God's plan for Joseph. We know that that's not just true in Joseph's life, that it's true of our own. Because the book of Acts, at Pentecost, Peter says that evil deeds did not stop Jesus' redemptive work, which allows us to have a relationship with God. He says, this man, Jesus, was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him on the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. We know that God can use all kinds of things, even evil things, for good, because of the story of Joseph and because of the life of Jesus. That even though Jesus lived a sinless life and he didn't deserve it, he suffered a terrible trial. He was falsely accused. He was beaten himself and hung on a cross as a criminal. But on that cross, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." And he cried out in agony, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And he did it so that he could also use those words, "It is finished," which means the price of and the punishment that you and I deserve has been completely paid. And so we know that God can use evil deeds, the evil deeds of the wicked people of Israel against Jesus for our good. And so when we see all chaos around us, when we wonder, where is God in all of this? When we look and we see nothing but compost and smell and manure around our lives, we need to remind ourselves of this truth, that God can use everything, everything, the good and the bad, for our good as well. That's why Romans 8:28 says, "For we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." This is the truth we need to hang on them. It's a COVID when we see all kinds of division and difficult things. This is the hope that we need to bank on when we lose our job or when our relationship's in turmoil. This is the hope that we need to bank our lives on when our health goes downward and we know not what to do. Because we know that God can use everything, including the difficult things, for good. It doesn't mean that it's easy. It doesn't mean that we're not going to question. It doesn't mean that we're not going to doubt and that we're not going to have to wrestle with difficult questions. But this is the truth that we need to imprint on our brains and deep into our hearts. That even though some things may seem as bad as that giraffe mom kicking the baby from underneath them, that God can use it to build us up and to build our faith and to put our hope and trust in him more. That our pain has a purpose. That our suffering is not wasted. Because God is greater than that. That same document, the Heidelberg Catechism, just the next question says this: how does the knowledge of God's creation and providence help us? This is the line I want you to remember. We can be patient when things go against us. That's really the heart of Joseph and the heart of the story. But also that we can be thankful when things go well, and for the future we can have good confidence in our faithful God and Father, that nothing in creation will separate us from his love. For all creatures are so completely in God's hand that without his will they cannot move or be moved. That's the truth that's going to hold us and guide us and sustain us through life's difficult times. And what we'll see at the end of the story of Joseph is that truth is actually what Joseph learned. That what his brothers intended for harm, God used for good. That's what gives us hope in the midst of all our pain and suffering. Let's pray.
You are listening to a sermon from Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington. You can learn more about our church online at crosswaychurchwa.com. We invite you to attend a worship service on Sundays at 10 a.m. at 311 North Parkway.